The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Catherine Lafferty argues that the drive to end teen pregnancies aided the grooming gangs. Following Luke Littler's win at the World Darts Championships last week, Michael Simmons says that Gen Z are ruining darts. Paul Wood examines America's unlikely new ally in the battle against the terrorist group ISIS. Philip Hensher takes us through the history of the Brothers Grimm and says that the words once upon a time once proved more dangerous than war or revolution. Isabel Hardman takes us through the new garden at the Natural History Museum and says that one of the most beautiful buildings in London has gained a wonderful garden to match its stature. And finally, why would anyone spend so much time looking at airplane crashes on YouTube? While Damian Thompson reveals why in his Guest Life column this week. Up first, Catherine Lafferty.
How did the depraved cruelty of Britain's grooming gangs go on for so long, so openly, with such seeming impunity? One overlooked but vitally important element of the scandal is that over the past 30 years, the lines of defence girls had against sex crimes were deliberately taken down in the drive to reduce the country's number of teenage pregnancies. The first and most important line of defence any girl will have against male predation is usually her own family. The first step in dismantling these defences came in 1985, when Victoria Gillick, a Catholic housewife, wanted assurances from her local health authority that her underage daughters would not be given contraceptives without her knowledge and consent. She lost the case, and consequently the Law Lords, led by Lord Fraser, set new guidelines under which underage sex would be officially tolerated as long as pregnancies were prevented. The Fraser guidelines were hailed by the teen sex lobby, which claimed they would usher in a world of empowered young women and falling teenage pregnancy rates. But things didn't go according to their confident forecasts. And by 1997, Britain's stubbornly high teenage pregnancy rate was the stuff of dozens of newspaper columns and radio phone-ins. What to do next was obvious: intensify the policy. The incoming Blair government gave itself a 10-year strategy to halve teenage pregnancy rates. There were task forces, advisory groups, interim targets, annual reports, workshops and drop-in centres. Confidentiality was central to the teenage pregnancy strategy. Yet, secrecy is also an abuser's most effective cloak. A court case in the mid-2000s expanded the boundaries of teenage sex confidentiality even further. Like Gillick, it was brought by another mother called Sue Axon, who fought a legal battle for parents to have the right to know if their underage daughters were being given abortion advice. Axon lost her case in 2006. It had been opposed by the then Health Secretary, Tricia Hewitt, who, in an earlier incarnation, had been General Secretary of the National Council for Civil Liberties when it was friendly with the Paedophile Information Exchange, as well as by the Family Planning Association. Quote, "Confidentiality is the single most important factor in a young person's decision to visit a health service," said Anne Wayman, chief executive of FPA, adding, "compulsory parental notification of their visit would have been a disaster." That was not a view that would be shared by the authors of the Rochdale Serious Case Review, which reported in 2013 that, quote, "the drive to reduce teenage pregnancy is believed to have contributed to a culture whereby professionals may have become inured to early sexual activity in young teenagers." Multiple serious case reviews found the focus on driving pregnancy rates down with confidential contraception and abortions meant that teenage girls who presented signs of sexual exploitation were dismissed because the assumption was that underage sexual activity was harmless so long as the risk of pregnancy was minimised. Torbay's serious case review observed, quote, underage sexual activity by young people between 13 and 16 years old is judged on the perception that if it takes place with partners of a similar age, it is by mutual consent. This perception has to be reconsidered in light of the growing evidence in this case that the abusers were not much older than the girls. Revelations continue rolling in. GB News has reported that one victim claims she was forced by a male police officer to take the morning after pill when she reported her abuse. In October 2005, the then Education Secretary Ruth Kelly tried to reverse the tide by proposing that every time anyone under the age of consent asked for advice on sex, contraception and abortion, the police would be notified. Her suggestion was shot down in flames by the teen sex lobby. Quote, "Any erosion of young people's rights to confidential sexual health advice and treatment would be disastrous," said Jan Barlow, the chief executive of the Brook Sexual Health Advisory Centres. It's clear now that the official recommendation as best practice for preventing pregnancies in underage girls was in direct conflict with safeguarding their best interests. Yet, according to the prevailing Fraser regime, the agencies that had declined to notify the police about underage sex had done nothing wrong.
That was Catherine Lafferty, and next, Michael Simmons.
Luke the Nuke Littler, born 2 weeks after the first iPhone was unveiled, stormed the Professional Darts Corporation World Championships last week to become, at 17, the sport's youngest ever world champion. How Littler behaved after his wins shows how different young sports stars are today. Littler didn't celebrate by going out drinking. No hotel rooms were trashed. Instead, within hours of his quarter and semi-final victories, he was on the video game streaming website Twitch via phone call to his red-headed gaming friend Morgan Birtswistle, known online as Angry Ginge. Angry Ginge, 23, is one of the UK's most popular streamers, with around 4 million followers across Twitch, YouTube and TikTok. Twitch allows you to observe the lives of men who spend most of their time in their bedrooms. Angry Ginge's fans can watch him playing video games, commenting on Premier League football matches and playing darts against himself, all in real time. It's a serious profession for Morgan. He's estimated to make up to £40,000 a month from Twitch and a similar amount from his YouTube channel, along with money from other social media platforms. Ginger's connection to Littler comes through his virtual football team, Gurfinturf. Littler occasionally plays in matches, on a multiplayer version of the FIFA football game, and their gameplay and banter are streamed to Ginger's thousands of avid viewers. These streams are often tagged as ADHD, which appears to be seen as a personality type within Gen Z. Streaming is the new drinking for semi-celebs, and it's not something they grow out of. Pieface, another member of Gurfinturf and a Littler clinger-on, is 15 years older than the darts champion, while Stephen the Bullet Bunting, a 39-year-old whom Littler beat in the semi-final, plays the children's video game Fortnite after he's finished with darts practice. Littler, a chubby teenager from Warrington, is far more media-savvy than many older players, an upside of living his life online. On one stream for the Gurfinturf team, a female voice, that turned out to be Littler's new girlfriend's, could be heard in the background of Littler's microphone saying she was going to bed, followed by the inevitable schoolyard ribbing from his teammates. Littler responded, "If someone has screen recorded that, it's in the papers in the morning. Yep, well played." He was right about it ending up in the papers. Dart frob, quipped the Sun. You can see the attraction of this lucrative online world for Littler. He's set to make millions more from sponsorship deals than from prize money, and his latest deal with Xbox is down to his love of gaming when he's away from the hockey. But it's hard not to think that this online living is deadly dull compared to past sporting excess. Compare Littler to someone like the snooker player Ronnie the Rocket O'Sullivan. He too won his first professional championship in his teens, but after a win, he would celebrate properly by causing havoc across London, not by sitting in his bedroom. That said, a more subdued atmosphere could be exactly what the darts establishment is aiming for. When the Spectators darts team took part in a promotional event for the PDC, we finished last, I interviewed Tom Kitchen, who was designing the hospitality menu for Alexander Palace, where the annual darts tournament is played. I joked to the Michelin-starred chef that a darts crowd was unlikely to enjoy the fancy hot cuisine served in his Edinburgh restaurants. He was slightly affronted. Hot cuisine is exactly what the darts crowd want now, he said. Gone are the days of lukewarm pies and an out-of-date packet of scampi fries. There are rumours too of a move to the Gulf for darts. The 90,000 tickets for this year's World Championships at Ali Pali sold out in just 15 minutes. Barry Hearn's Matchroom Sport, which effectively owns darts, reckons that the World Championships could have sold 3 times as many tickets if they had been held in a bigger venue. Given that Hearn recently moved some snooker tournaments to Saudi Arabia, there are fears darts could be heading the same way. Another reason to stay sober. Littler is extremely talented. It's plausible that, like Ronnie the Rocket, he'll still be winning titles 20 years from now. Perhaps he'll win the 2046 World Championships in Riyadh. But back home, all the pubs will be closed, Angry Ginge will be angry bald, and all the 6-year-old men watching the darts via his Twitch channel will still be tuning in from their childhood bedrooms.
That was Michael Simmons. And now, Paul Wood.
ISIS are back. In fact, to borrow Gerry Adams' remark about the IRA, they never went away. Now they're regaining some of their previous strength in Syria and Iraq and moving into fresh territory in Africa. Of most importance to the West, the Afghan branch of ISIS, ISIS Khorasan, is said to be plotting more direct attacks on the far enemy, as well as pumping out propaganda to create so-called lone wolves. But with the stakes rising, it seems the United States may have found a new ally in the battle against ISIS, the Taliban, the enemy of my enemy. We're talking about ISIS again because last week a convert drove his pickup truck into a dense crowd out partying on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, killing 14 people. Shamsuddin Jabbar acted alone, according to the FBI, and was also clearly a troubled man. He was in turmoil after getting divorced and recorded a message for his family saying he'd like to kill them too. I don't want you to think I spared you willingly. As so often with lone wolves, the question is whether he became violent because he was radicalised or became radicalised because he was violent. Lone wolf or lone nut, there was plenty of ISIS material online to inspire him. One ISIS media campaign has the slogan, "Run them over without mercy," along with a cartoon of a 4x4 crushing the skulls of unbelievers. This is a variation on a regular ISIS meme, "Kill them wherever you find them," a phrase from the Quran. This poison is injected into social media from many places, by ISIS fanboys as much as by some central authority, but much of it seems to come from ISIS Khorasan or ISIS K in Afghanistan. The Austrian authorities say they arrested 3 teenagers planning an attack on a Taylor Swift concert in Vienna after joining an ISIS-K group on Telegram. The teenagers allegedly wanted to kill as many people as possible using knives, machetes and homemade explosives, and once again by mowing them down with a car or truck. Luckily, their preparations were amateurish and perhaps only possible at all because the parents of one of the boys were away. It was lucky, too, that though the attacker in New Orleans had once served in the US Army, it was as a specialist in HR and IT. Better trained and better armed attackers could spill a great deal more blood, as when 130 people were murdered by ISIS gunmen and suicide bombers at the Bataclan Theatre and elsewhere in Paris 10 years ago. ISIS carried out an attack in Moscow last March that might have been modelled on Bataclan. 4 gunmen wearing military fatigues and masks opened fire with assault rifles on a crowd at the Crocus City Hall. The popular Russian band Picnic were about to go on stage, having sold out the venue. Many in the audience thought at first the gunshots were part of the act. The gunmen stepped over their bodies, finishing off the wounded by slitting their throats, telling each other, "Kill them and have no mercy," and intoning, "God is greatest." 140 people died. The following day, the senior American general in the Middle East, Eric Kurilla, warned that ISIS-K also had the capability and the will to attack Western targets with little to no warning. Having left Afghanistan, the US military finds it difficult to keep a close eye on what ISIS-K is up to there. Washington is virtually blind inside Afghanistan, but it is listening. I've been told by 2 people who regularly speak to senior Taliban officials that the US is passing them intelligence on ISIS-K. An American general and his team are said to meet the Taliban in Qatar to hand over any material, presumably electronic intercepts, that might help in targeting the group. The Taliban have long been waging their own war against ISIS in Afghanistan. They compete with one another for territory and recruits, ISIS-K was formed by disaffected Pakistani Talibs, and they follow different schools of Sunni Islam. ISIS think the Taliban are apostates, making their killing lawful under the ISIS interpretation of Islamic law. Officially, the Taliban deny they're working with the Americans. Suhail Shaheen, who heads the Taliban's office in Qatar, told me, "We are carrying out operations against ISIS-K independently, without any cooperation with any side." That wasn't surprising. It would be extremely embarrassing for the Taliban to admit they're in a military alliance with the country's former invaders and occupiers. I was also told that intelligence is flowing the other way, with the Taliban giving Western governments what they learn from phones and laptops seized in raids on ISIS-K compounds. The two people I spoke to, who are in regular contact with the Taliban, said that an attack on the Paris Olympics had been stopped with intelligence obtained in this way. Again, that has not been confirmed, but the stories are plausible. Back in July, NBC reported that the Biden administration was considering how it could cooperate with the Taliban against ISIS. Officials at the White House were said to be weighing whether to share more information about ISIS-K. Such a secret arrangement would suit both the Americans and the Taliban. Again, that has not been confirmed, but the stories are plausible. Back in July, NBC reported that the Biden administration was considering how it could cooperate with the Taliban against ISIS. Officials at the White House were said to be weighing whether to share more information about ISIS-K. Such a secret arrangement would suit both the Americans and the Taliban. In Syria and Iraq, meanwhile, there were some 700 attacks by ISIS last year, according to one count. Those attacks were small. ISIS isn't about to sweep over large parts of Syria and Iraq to re-establish the caliphate that attracted wide-eyed young Muslims dissatisfied with life in the corrupt West. There may be relatively few hardcore, active ISIS loyalists in Iraq and Syria. One estimate put it at little more than 1,000, but there is vast potential for growth. For the time being, it is the electronic jihad that matters most. The voices of ISIS multiplied and spread across social media by the powerful new technology of AI. It was the electronic jihad that recruited Shamsuddin Jabbar, the New Orleans attacker. In one of his messages, he said that Muslims listening to rap music, the voice of Satan as he called it, was a sign of the end times. There would now be a war between the believers and the disbelievers. ISIS can never win such a war, but the lone wolves who think they're fighting it will always be with us.
That was Paul Wood. Next, Philip Hensher.
It might help if we stopped calling them the Brothers Grimm, which always makes them sound like characters in one of their own fairy tales. We don't talk about the sisters Bronte, after all. In reality, Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm have been described very accurately as visionary drudges. The Children's and Household Tales, the first edition of which was published in 1812, was only a part of their grand project to establish a German cultural and linguistic identity. The brothers were primarily philologists, concerned with the meaning and history of words, and their investigation of German folk culture, narratives, myths, and legends was rooted in an austere examination of language. Household tales came at the beginning of long careers and were followed by much more rigorous projects. A study of German legends and an extremely taxing and thorough work on German mythology followed. One might guess that when George Eliot makes it clear in Middlemarch that Mr. Casaubon can't write the key to all mythologies because he's ignorant of German, she has Jakob Grimm's 1835 German mythologies in mind. Jakob's linguistic works include a history of the German language and a remarkable German grammar, which would, on its own, have preserved his name. He would have preferred it to have been called Germanic grammar, since it explores the relation between different Germanic languages, including English. Since William Jones's lectures in Calcutta in the 1780s, scholars had been investigating the links between Indian languages such as Sanskrit and those of modern Europe. Jones's example was the journey of the Sanskrit word duhita, perhaps one who brings the milk, to the English word daughter. Jakob patiently mapped the morphological changes, and established Grimm's law for the way sounds shift, which still holds. Then there is the great dictionary of the German language, the Deutsches Wörterbuch. The first volumes were published in the brothers' lifetimes, the first in 1854. Wilhelm died in 1859, Jakob in 1863. But it wasn't completed until 1961, by which time a unique diplomatic agreement for cooperation between West and East Germany was necessary. By contrast, the New English Dictionary, or the OED, was published from 1884 to 1928. The Wörterbuch aimed at scientific rigour, but there were some idiosyncrasies that had to be curbed as the project proceeded. The Grimm's definitions of Amtmann, district magistrate, for instance, mentioned Our Blessed Mother, and that of Ablass, indulgence, took the opportunity to glorify the triumph of Protestantism. These were lapses much more like those of Dr. Johnson than James Murray. Some of the etymological speculation doesn't remotely stand up. For example, establishing a connection between the adjective arm, meaning paw, and the noun arm, on the grounds that one might put a consoling arm around someone's paw. There was also the eccentrically crusading decision to abolish the utilization of German nouns, and perhaps most tellingly, the decision to exclude most words of foreign origin, even if they were in quite common use. This decision to exclude foreign elements as if they were tainting Germanic purity influenced other parts of the Grimm's work. In later editions of the Household Tales, the brothers removed stories such as Puss in Boots and Bluebeard that had come to seem rooted in French versions. Although they maintained an interest in cross-cultural ancestries, their main concern was to establish a coherent and perhaps even exclusive body of German culture. Household Tales attempted the impossible task of interesting both scholars, who were presented with an apparatus of narratological variants, and small children who would just enjoy the stories. This was very different to the English language series of Andrew Lang's Fairy Books, 1889-1913, which reached out to a huge range of world folk tales in a mild spirit of imperialist anthropology. Household Tales actually only attained their monumental standing after the Grimm's death, with the unification of Germany and the decades of nationalism which led to catastrophe. Not even Richard Wagner was so focused on the Germanic, setting two of his operas in Spain and Cornwall. In retrospect, the Grimm's inclusion of grossly anti-Semitic stories had a sinister significance, but the emphasis on cultural purity did the worst damage. A further point of consideration might be the Grimm's dependence on much more educated sources than their English language equivalent. All the contributors to the first volume of the dictionary were professors, philologists, and clergymen, and Jakob discouraged contributions from unknown members of the public, very different from Murray's wide-flung net. For the tales, the Grimms liked it to be thought that they had gathered folk stories from travelling widely and listening to simple folk. They made quite a deal out of Dorothea Wiemann, their one peasant-like source, including a picturesque biography of her and even, in one edition, her portrait. In fact, most of the stories were supplied by a small number of highly educated women of their acquaintance. They themselves were well-connected gentry, with relations in various small German courts, without a great deal of money to hand. Still, despite reservations and conspicuous limitations, the brothers achieved a colossal amount in setting cultural and linguistic analysis on a solid footing. Unfortunately, they were largely dependent on the whims of patron princes, which could change for no reason. The presentation of a major work to a prince might elicit the response that it was to be hoped the Grimms had not neglected the paid sinecures as court librarians. Jakob went as far as to take diplomatic posts and even attended the Congress of Vienna in an official capacity. When a prince took umbrage, it could be disastrous. Both brothers lost their jobs at the University of Göttingen when the King of Hanover decided to intervene and sacked seven professors of liberal tendency. This was Queen Victoria's wicked uncle, the Duke of Cumberland. The throne's of Hanover, and England had divided at her succession since Hanover operated under Salic law. The dictionary only came about because the Grimms had to move to Berlin and find some way of making a living. Anne Schmiesing's book is a reliable account of Jacob and Wilhelm's careers, admirably knowledgeable about the intricate world of the princely states the pair negotiated and the intellectual milieu of idealistic German nationalism that is now so hard to disentangle from its barbaric subsequent developments. The poet Brentano's interest in folk poetry and the jurist Savini's suggestion that the innate spirit of a nation forms its laws are mined to good effect. The brothers were, in fact, very different in temperament. Jacob much more inward and rigorous, Wilhelm a cheerful family man whose independent work, such as his book on runes, is of much less solid quality than his brother's. Schmiesing does a good job in suggesting how their work, which they believed addressed eternal German verities, reflected the interests of their time. Hansel and Gretel was altered so that it's a stepmother who behaves cruelly. The sources all indicate a mother, but 19th century sensibilities could not endure such a smear on the natural feelings of motherhood. The book does betray occasional attempts at hipness, perhaps the result of years of trying to hold the attention of American undergraduates. The Grimms were not project managers, and once he'd look at paintings in France, Jacob found that gaining access to these spaces was a hassle. But I think we can put up with that. On the whole, this is a thought-provoking discussion of the truth that the most dangerous act in the world, the thing with the most lasting and least predictable consequences, is not war or revolution, it's simply writing down the words Es war einmal, once upon a time, and watching blood, revenge, gory redemption, and the immensely satisfying murder of the uncivilized unfold.
That was Philip Hentscher. And now, Isabel Hartman.
The Natural History Museum is one of the most beautiful buildings in London, but its gardens have long been a bit boring. Just a pavement on the way into Alfred Waterhouse's ornate Cathedral to Nature. Most people noticed them solely when the ice rink appeared at Christmas. There was a wildlife garden in one corner that only real enthusiasts, like me, bothered to visit. With this enormous overhaul of the site, that's all changed. The scale of the Evolution Garden, designed by landscape architects J&L Gibbons and architects Field and Fowles, is enormous, both in size and the period of time it covers. Instead of hauling yourself up a sharp flight of steps from the tube, you now saunter through a ravine of rocks 3 billion years old. These huge, crashing cliffs start with the oldest rock in the British Isles, Lewisian gneiss, and move through Torridonian sandstone, Cambrian quartzite, and Welsh heather slate. The rocks continue through the Evolution Garden, creating spines and barriers to divide rampaging children from the new planting. You can enjoy these plants from a series of benches, also hewn from interesting rocks, including some striking, beautifully smooth white chalk and flint benches. I will get on to the planting in a minute, but the bones of this design are beautiful too. The pavements are really very clever. They teach you things without ever being earnest. The brass inlays describe fossils, geological eras, and processes such as volcanic eruptions and extinctions. By the time the path reaches the end of the garden, human footprints emerge, and the terrazzo throws up evidence of human life, including shards of blue glass, pottery and plastics. Humans come onto the scene pretty late, and so do flowers, which is why the planting is largely foliage focused. Hundreds of huge tree ferns dominate the understory of the even bigger plane trees that tower above. There are smaller ferns such as Dryopteris affinis and early grass-like plants including carex, while Pachysandra terminalis covers the ground with its glossy evergreen leaves. This is both accurate in evolutionary terms, but also means that the garden still looks great, even in the colder months. Conifers, including the truly prehistoric Wollemi pine, Wollemia nobilis, and various dwarf forms of pine, sit underneath the huge bronze cast of a dinosaur skeleton. Magnolias are an honourable flowering exception in the design. They evolved before bees and were pollinated by beetles, which is why their waxy flowers are so thick and robust. When the development was first mooted, there was a furious campaign against the changes. The wildlife garden used to be a peaceful space, quite messy and enclosed. The campaigners were worried about the disruption to the ecosystem. Their concerns were entirely understandable, but have turned out to be misplaced. The garden still has piles of dead wood to attract invertebrates and encourage fungi. It still has a wildlife pond, meadowy parts, and looser areas of coppiced hazel, brambles, and ivy. But they are now framed within a more intentional design that everyone can get close to. A sweeping terrazzo path takes you right into the centre of the pond, which is still gloriously messy and teeming with life. A classroom harvests rainwater from its roof and channels it along a rill and through swales, storing it underground. Most designers would just be happy with the latter, but this lot have actually managed to make the drainage system beautiful too. Elsewhere in the wildlife garden, more brass inlays intersect the path like tree roots. One tree stump has a secret cast of an Earth Star on its side. It is beautiful and thoughtful, and you don't often get to say that about hard landscaping the public realm, let alone a project that was initially threatening to undermine a wildlife garden, not enhance it. In fact, it's the hard landscaping that's the real joy of the whole set of gardens around the museum. Yes, the big bronze cars of the Diplodocus is impressive, and yes, the planting is inspired. But where else in London could you walk 3 billion years along pavements so good that you want to photograph them? It's a triumph, and deserves its place at the foot of Waterhouse's wonderful building. You might even forget to go inside.
That was Isabel Hardman. And finally, Damien Thompson.
How do you live with yourself when 179 air passengers are burned alive on a South Korean runway, and you've spent the last few weeks binge-watching YouTube videos about plane crashes? The obvious answer is I need to seek help. I have a defence, but I don't think any British jury would buy it. I started watching the air crash videos to escape the anxiety caused by the American presidential election. Anxiety that Donald Trump might lose, that is. I can imagine Emily Makeless and Rory Stewart's reaction. Self-declared Trump supporter chills out by imagining planes full of holidaymakers falling out of the sky. That figures. But I don't care what they think. Their horror-struck faces were one of the joys of election night. Not that I saw it live. I was so freaked out by the prospect of a Kamala Harris victory that I handed over my SIM card and router to a friend to avoid the agony of watching it unfold. I know this sounds completely loopy, but I blame YouTube, the crystal meth of online entertainment for people like me who can't let go of their pet topics. My childhood was dominated by a smorgasbord of obsessions. Sherlock Holmes, Doctor Who, coin collecting, and Beethoven. Even today, my old schoolmates shudder at the memory of my playground lectures. Did they know that the George III's 1787 sixpence came in two varieties, with and without a semi of hearts? Or that Beethoven wrote alternative finales to his string quartet, Opus 130? Or that, like the unseen flower in Thomas Gray's Elegy, I was wasting my sweetness on the desert air? But on YouTube, there's always someone listening. It's an all-you-can-eat buffet for monomaniacs. Henry Kissinger once said that the bitterness of academic politics was in inverse proportion to the importance of the subject. I noticed the same thing when I got into vaping. I logged onto YouTube and found a real battlefield. Tattooed experts poured scorn on each other's coil-building techniques, but reserved their deepest contempt for stealth vapors who inhaled puffs from their mouth rather than dragging clouds straight into their lungs. Not wanting to seem a wimp, I collected a drawer full of sub-ohm tanks that blasted out Arctic ice or butterscotch cheesecake. After 6 months of hacking up my lungs, I threw it all out. The habit cost me $2,000. I resolved to stay clear of YouTube pundits. I was doing okay until last summer, when I became obsessed with the US election. I convinced myself that Western civilization couldn't survive 4 years of Kamala's well-lubricated cackle. With polls showing razor-thin margins for both candidates, I turned back to YouTube for reassurance. I sat through 5 podcasts a night. In the end, I couldn't go to the supermarket without number-crunching the Electoral College. If he wins North Carolina and Georgia, but loses Pennsylvania, does he need Wisconsin and Michigan to reach 270? Unintended item in bagging area. A colleague suggested a diversion. Once you discover Mentor Pilot, you'll be hooked, he said. He covers air crashes, but tastefully. Mentor Pilot is Captain Petter Hundfeldt, a Swedish commercial pilot who explains the technical mishaps that send jets hurtling into oceans or cliffs. His lilting voice, sharp scripts, and slick graphics flatter you into thinking you understand, sort of, how a faulty angle of an attack vane can cause the manual and automatic speed trim systems to fight each other. The suspense builds as you wait to discover how disaster will strike. I wouldn't describe Mentor Pilot's YouTube channel as soothing exactly, but in my frazzled state it felt less disturbing than the notorious Seltzer poll showing Kamala winning Iowa. And Captain Petter is tasteful, so long as you ignore the clickbait thumbnails on his homepage. "Never saw it coming," shrieked one headline, with a helpful arrow pointing to the mountain looming in front of a jet. There are no grisly photographs, and he never discusses crashes under investigation, which rules out the Jeju air disaster. By the 6th of November, it was safe to return to US politics channels. But there's a limit to how much conservative gloating you can take. Yes, it's fun to watch Rachel Maddow gasping like a guppy fish in a compilation of best liberal election night meltdowns. But after a few hundred replays, even that gets old. Enough digital poison, I thought. Time for an analogue antidote. My collection of classical LPs from the golden age of stereo, cut from master tapes and pressed on vinyl. The problem? The maddening mystery of static. Everyone agrees that the correct cleaning routine eliminates crackle. No one agrees on the details. So, now I'm back on YouTube, listening to thunderous philippics against heretics who use too much isopropyl alcohol in their distilled water or buy a vacuum instead of an ultrasonic cleaning machine. I've acquired all the liquids, an anti-static gun, 2 rival machines, and after every mesmerizingly dull lecture, I test its recommendations. Do any of them work? It's too early to say. I still have at least a dozen vinyl cleaning recipes to try. As for actually listening to music, isn't that what Spotify is for?
And that's everything for this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate a review and a follow however you subscribe to your podcasts. I'm Petra Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.